Good morning. My name is Bob Pinner, and I along with Bob Rolfs from Utah, co-chair this task force, CDC and CSTE, with considerable help from APHL task force on ELR. This is a small, intimate group of people who are familiar with this, so the acronym is probably okay. So this morning's session will be to provide an update for y'all on work in various, in five different working groups that comprise the efforts of this task force over about the past year. But just a couple of words of introduction. Okay, so a little bit on where we are, an overview of the task group, and then reports from each of the chairs or co-chairs of the work groups. So just a little bit of context. This is a picture, a slide from 2005, MMWR in 2005, that made an effort to show something about electronic disease surveillance efforts and ELR across the country. So sort of reading from the MMWR, as of April of 2005, a total of 27 state health departments and two municipal health departments, New York City and LA, were entering at least some notifiable disease data using a secure internet-based system. That's one. And then the second point from this, as of also April of 2005, a total of 26 state health departments, not counting the ones who were only getting blood lead levels, received laboratory results, test results, electronically via ELR, and the remaining 24 states were in various stages of preparing for ELR. So I showed this slide for a couple of reasons. One is to show that efforts in standards-based electronic approaches to improve surveillance, and specifically ELR, have been going on for a long time. Even at that time, there was some activity and some information flowing electronically. We're in a considerably different place now, lots of progress since then. But that also brings me to the second reason I show this slide, because the truth is, I don't really have an up-to-date one that's very informative about all the different dimensions we and you all would be interested in. How many states, using what approaches, related to and conforming to meaningful use standards, from how many labs, for how many and which conditions. And one theme of our efforts at CDC and working with state health departments over the next several months will be to do a better job to get a better handle on where things stand. Well, I think I'm going to skip this slide because you all can speak to meaningful use 231 versus 251 standards better than I can, to show a really oversimplified graph of ELR status in state health departments. So there's at least some ELR going on in 43 health departments that are in our information base, and much of that is coming from the large labs, although in 24 jurisdictions there are, you know, hospital labs reporting as well. If you looked at this by volume, the large labs, which constitute lots of volume, the graph would be much higher, presumably, relative to the hospital labs. And if you look at where, what implementation nationwide would look like, the volume in the large labs would be quite high, though their number might be smaller, and the number of hospital labs obviously would be quite high. Although maybe collectively, each one may not contribute by itself much in the way of volume. A little bit of update and information on some things we've been able to do at CDC through the Prevention and Public Health Fund of the Affordable Care Act. This is a news release from, the 22nd, so a week ago today. CDC awards more than $49 million to strengthen state and local health departments. And a chunk of that related to ELR has been in part of what's in the Epidemiology and Laboratory Capacity, or ELC, cooperative agreement, which goes to all 50 states and 8 large local jurisdictions. About a little less than half of that, $23 million, were to continue activities funded last year in EPI, lab, and information systems, and around $31 million were enhancements, one sort of area is healthcare-associated infections, but the other big area of emphasis relevant for this group was to focus on ELR, and maybe about $16 million are dedicated investments out of this current round for that, which when taken together with other ELC investments and funds that you all used through the Public Health and Emergency Preparedness, or FEP, cooperative agreement, sort of summarizes some of what at CDC we were able to do to try to help this along. So in the CSTE meeting of 2009, there was a resolution that asked CDC, together with CSTE, to put together a task force on ELR to sort of rededicate efforts and to work through some loose ends, work that needed to be done to move this along in a better way. So we did that. Bob Rolfs and I co-chair, and have engaged a large number of others, co-chairs whom you'll hear from, many of you in the room now and in lots of places, to work through the work, the working groups that make up the task force. I won't steal your thunder, Shu. So let me introduce now Shu McGarvey, who's been working as the executive secretary, coordinating the efforts of the task force, its work groups, and their deliverables. One other comment, this is August 22nd, so the middle of September, the steering committee for our task force will meet in person in Atlanta to sort of try to pull together and bring to a completion the work of this task force. So by that time, our sort of goal for ourselves is to have what we said we would do largely done, deliverables we said we'd produce largely produced, and things that need ongoing work, of which there are plenty, identified clearly and making sure they have a home for getting things done. So with that, let me introduce Shu McGarvey.
Thank you, Bob. You could have kept going. That was great. Welcome, everybody. As Dr. Penner said, he and Bob Rolfs initiated this task force back in 2010. And in 2010, there was a steering committee meeting where 5 priorities were set forward. And born from those 5 priorities were the work groups that constitute this task force on ELR. And the main focus of the task force is to promote and advance ELR in the U.S. As you know or may know, ELR is one of the first 3 population health objectives for meaningful use of health information technology. It's reportable laboratory results, which made it even more critical to try and push this forward and to put the components in place that enabled states and healthcare to adhere to the requirements of reportable lab results, the population health objective. We're very excited with the work that has been accomplished so far. The vision of this task force, more specifically, is for all labs, both public and private, conducting clinical testing to identify laboratory results that indicate a potential reportable condition for one of the jurisdictions they serve, to format that information in a standard manner, and transmit the appropriate messages to all of the jurisdictions. All jurisdictions at the same time should be able to receive and consume the messages that they're sent. So that's quite a vision, and while a good deal of work has been done toward reaching these goals and this vision, there's still quite a bit of work left to be done. I'm going to be very brief so that you can hear the work that's been done so far. As Dr. Pinner said, there is a steering committee meeting for our task force in September where we'll talk about many of the gaps that still remain, as well as strategies for transitioning some of the ongoing work, as well as finding homes for our new efforts that still need to be put into place to get ELR where it needs to be. So what is the organization of the task force? As I mentioned, there are five work groups, which I'm hoping you can see the slide from the back of the room down at the bottom. The co-chairs are Dr. Rolfs and Dr. Pinner. Dr. Pinner here at CDC, and Dr. Pinner is the director of the Emerging Infections and Surveillance Services division at the CDC. Bob, is that wrong? You're shaking your head. All of the people who are on this task force have other day jobs, and one thing I want to bring forward is that this has been a hugely collaborative effort between CDC and CSTE and APHL. This couldn't have happened without that collaborative effort, and certainly not without APHL's help in so many areas. This task force has been working tirelessly to complete some of the elements that you'll hear about throughout this conference. And we have a couple of slides at the very end to point you to other sessions that you can attend. You may have already heard about the reportable condition mapping table. You may have already heard about the reportable condition knowledge base if you were here yesterday for some of the sessions. Much of the vocabulary and standards work has been done, at least in part, under the guise and with the collaboration of members of this work group. So we look forward to sharing all of this with you. Anyway, we have the co-chairs of Dr. Rolfs and Dr. Pinner, the steering committee. Many of the members of the steering committee, you know these names. They are also on our work groups as co-chairs. We couldn't have done this without the logistics and coordination assistance of Kaylee Smith and Monica Wong of CSTE. Thank you so much to both of them. And then, of course, our advisors from CSTE, CDC, and APHL. The first task force you'll hear from is the Standards Work Group. The Standards Work Group has focused on standards and vocabulary to support ELR, and more specifically, to support ELR for meaningful use. LIS vendors and large labs have put together recommendations and guidelines for labs to follow, as well as for LIS vendors to consider as they try and meet the objective of reportable laboratory results. Legal considerations is looking across the jurisdictions at considerations that states need to make when they try and put legislation about ELR into place. Resource Needs and Assessment Work Group is dealing with what are the resources that you need to implement ELR, and if you've initially implemented ELR, what are the resources you need to carry it forward. Finally, the Meaningful Use Work Group has focused on many of the communications pieces and the meaningful use specific components of ELR. So, the work groups, the very first one we have is the Standards Work Group. And I'm going to introduce Dari Shirazi. He is the co-chair of the Standards Work Group, along with Rita Altimore, who is with CSTE. Dari is with APHL. Dari, do you want to come up here? Dari's day job is as the director of IT for the University of Iowa's Hygienic Lab. I have to say, these guys have been like the superstars. They've been like a task force unto themselves. The amount of work that they've gotten done is simply unbelievable. Many of you who are out here have been a part of all of this, and we thank all of you for your input and your collaboration.
Good morning, everyone. I'm extremely pleased to be here presenting the work that the Standards Work Group has done in the past 8 months, talk about some of the accomplishments that benefits all of you, and lay out a couple of ongoing tasks that we are yet to complete and give you a time frame for that. The charge for the Standards Work Group was to harmonize the existing ELR messaging and vocabulary. We're not going to create new standards, but rather to find the standards and promote them. And finally, to provide guidance regarding implementation of messaging and vocabulary. And to that end, we embarked on several projects. I think every one of you have heard about RCMT in the past 6 months. If you haven't heard about RCMT, then you haven't been in any teleconference. Because I can tell you, Sundag has been to every teleconference across this nation that has the letters E, L, or R in it, in any combination. ELC, SLC, LED, anything. He has had 15 minutes presenting about RCMT. They have done a fantastic job about it. The other projects are to define requirements for reportable condition knowledge base, the clarification document for ELR 251 implementation guide, a review team that looked at ELR 231 to 251 and 251 to 231 HL7 mapper, a catalog of lab data exchange projects, a set of requirements for educational resources and tools web portal, a document describing best practices for those that are trying to implement ELR. There are several detailed presentations this week about RCMT, and I encourage all of you to attend some of those. So what is RCMT? RCMT is a table that maps laboratory tests and results using Loink and SNOMED to reportable conditions. It's used by health department and others to filter and route tests of public health interest. It includes all the nationally notifiable conditions, as well as those that are state, county, and territories. The work group has completed stage one, and actually we said one plus on this, because they did more than what they set out to do. They actually accomplished a lot more. Everything that the work group did is available through the PH Connect website. Their test schedule as they went through all the tests, discussion about each of the conditions, and the recording of their public teleconferences. So if you missed a few, you can go and listen to what went on during that meeting. And it's a fairly comprehensive site and everything about RCMT. And the entire content of the work that they did, the mapping table and so forth, is available through the FinBads in several different formats. There are a couple of things that I wanted to highlight about RCMT because I think they're important for every project that we want to do. One is the outreach that RCMT did with all those groups. Being part of public health laboratory, I would often get emails from coworkers saying, "Did you know about RCMT? And are we involved with it?" It was through those processes that they got informed and they wanted to share that information with everyone else. So I think the level of effort that was put in informing people, put toward asking people to participate, is essential for any large project. I think RCMT did a very good job doing that. The other point that I wanted to make is the level of effort that went into the project. As we worked to transition RCMT from our work group to a sustainable model, I think it's very useful for decision makers to have these type of statistics so they can make knowledgeable decisions about the project cost, time estimates, and resources needed. I know many states have their own small RCMT table that they use within their own state. I know Iowa does. And although it doesn't cost as much as this to create and maintain a smaller table, that effort needs to be multiplied by 60 or 70 jurisdictions to come up with an accurate cost. And I would argue that would be huge huge sum of time and effort that everybody is spending doing this. As we were working on the beginnings of RCMT, there were a lot of discussions about adding columns to carry additional information, jurisdictional information, age-related conditions, and so forth. There were a lot of needs for a lot of information to be managed. And from those discussions, the work group realized that we needed a knowledge base, that we don't want to put all those requirements as extra columns in RCMT. It doesn't fit very well. It was from that process that we started another project called the Reportable Condition Knowledge Base. So our hope is to centralize information system to create a centralized information that's queryable by human and machines. And the premise of centralization will enable us to reduce overall cost and time effort for everyone. That it may improve timeliness of public health case reporting, and that through queryable interface, we can provide the means for electronic. The theme this morning was not making things, but providing information so other people can make things. So provide means for electronic case detection and reporting. There is a full-day workshop this Thursday in Hanover. Did I say that right? Hanover. Attended by a lot of smart folks that are going to help us put the next steps together. I was not invited to that. I don't know why. So the hope is to develop requirements that support public health reporting, public health business process. The plan is to look at existing models and not to start from scratch, to explore case reporting, notification, and surveillance in a holistic way, understanding that there are constraints. We can't do everything at once. And Cindy Binion has created a PH Connect site for the knowledge-based workshop. Please go and take a look. The other work that the work group has completed is the ELR implementation guide, errata, and clarification document. The document has 69 technical correction, typos, and guidance. The document has been approved by HL7 peer group, work group, and will be sent to HL7 for publication. Our group is also working, is also helping to review two HL7 mappers. The mappers are just for ELR messages. We think the mappers are going to be very useful to your health departments and all of you, as a matter of fact, that want to do ELR. For health departments that are moving to 251 infrastructure, it allows them to receive 251 messages now and downshift them to 231 so they can consume it because they have that infrastructure. And once they move to 251 infrastructure, continue to receive 231 messages that can be upgraded to 251, so they don't have to maintain two different infrastructure, a 231 infrastructure and a 251 infrastructure. So the review is working with CDC teams to have that accomplished. The mapper, a list of issues, and their proposed solutions will be available later on next month, in September. Much like the other standard groups, we did an environmental survey looking within our own domain, looking at data exchange projects. The information that was collected was informative to the work group, but also can be used by those of you that are looking to join a specific ELR initiatives. The document has 19 projects, and 54 CDC surveillance systems. When we started this work group, one of our goals was to publish our documents and resources in a way that you didn't have to go to a bunch of different places to find the information, one-stop shopping, if you will. CST is currently working on a set of web pages that will allow us to do just that. Publish guidance documents linked to vocabulary standards, and to provide you guys with tools and that will make your job easier, like MQF. I'll move faster. The challenge and best practice document is a work in process. The challenge and best practice document is a work in process. The goal is to the goal of this document is to help people that are implementing ELR to learn from others, and so they don't have to start from ground zero. The wiki is currently maintained on hl7.org, and we have some initial content. We are hoping to have it done before the work group completed tasks. This is really my thank you list. So many people have worked so hard on this work group, providing their knowledge, their expertise, their resources, without them, there would be nothing to present today. This is especially true of dedicated staff. Sundak, Cindy, Kelly, Sanjeev, Jerry, Sable, Mary Hamilton, Shu, and many, many others. Thanks to all of you. We have a very nice work group and very productive. Thank you, everyone.
And Dari, thank you to you and to Rita Altimore for leading the efforts of that work group. It has truly been amazing to see. Our next work group is our Meaningful Use work group, and that was led by Jim Kirkwood, who I saw in the audience somewhere. Where did he go? And Perry Smith. And Perry is going to give you an update on the Meaningful Use work group.
Thank you, Perry. Thanks, Shu. It's a pleasure to be here, and I want to also acknowledge the hard work of the committee members, Jim Kirkwood, who had to run out, I think, to another breakout session, and to Shu and Bob Pinner and all everyone. There are too many people to name. For those of us older folks who have been working on electronic lab reporting for years, over a decade, we thought we'd never, I think, reach this point where some of the energies all came together and national impetus under meaningful use really lit a fire for us all in public health for implementing electronic lab reporting. So it's very gratifying for those of us who have been working on this for so long to see the high percentage of states that now have implemented ELR that Bob Pinner showed on one of his slides. I think we're getting there. Our work group was focused because of meaningful use at the national level, was focused on trying to tie all of the public health ELR efforts into meaningful use, and really it was mostly a communications effort. States were feeling at a loss as to how to implement meaningful use for ELR and where to get information, and so you'll see that a lot of the work that we were doing as a work group, a committee, was to establish communication lines, and a lot of that happened actually internally at CDC, so a lot of the success of the story that I'm about to tell the credit should go to CDC staff. So our main purpose was to develop a strategic plan for coordination and communication among the states. And let's see, how do I make this go forward? Just click, yes. And we had a number of products that we worked on, or have been working on and continue to work on, that are listed here, and I'm over the next few slides, I'm going to say a few things about them quickly. I'm not going to take a lot of time to talk about the communications plan and the consolidated document on funding sources and terminology and the other things you see on this slide. The one thing I don't have is the second item, consolidated facts. I don't have a slide on that, which was an oversight, frankly, but is probably the most important process and output from this work group. Once a question was raised about how does a vendor or a state or a laboratory implement this aspect of meaningful use for ELR, once that question's been asked, we really didn't have a national way to answer the question. And sometimes the person with the answer was at ONC, or was over at CMS, or was at CDC, or was at the Medicaid office in the state in question. We had no way to really figure out who to ask the question to, who really had the definitive answer, and then once we got an answer, how do we record it so that it can be preserved so that when other people ask the same question, they get the same answer? And how would everybody know where to go to get to find that? And so probably the most important product was that CDC has established an internal process, and we have a roadmap for how to ask the question, where to get the answer, how to figure out who to get the answer, and we will end up with one public website where all of these facts will be listed. So I, again, feel that this is probably one of the most important aspects of our output, and will be referred to in some of these other slides, but I don't have a slide specifically for it. One thing we're currently working on is the communications plan for ELR. This is simply a document that is near completion that hopefully will be a document that contains all of the information that a person needs, whether they sit at the federal or state or local level, at the vendor, from a vendor's perspective, or a laboratory or a hospital perspective or a CMS perspective, wherever they sit, hopefully they can go to this document and figure out who they should be talking to either ask a question or to get an answer, and how information should flow at the throughout the nation at all levels. So this plan is really strategic. It's a high-level plan with a background and purpose. It will list the stakeholders and have websites and a flow diagram of how to get information. So that will be a nice resource, hopefully, when that is completed. We also have put together, thanks to, again, work mainly by CDC, documents on funding sources. We currently have two documents, as you see here on this slide, available, and this will be updated as new funding availability comes along, so that folks will know who has been awarded money, or hopefully funding announcements, so that if there's new funding opportunities, they will be posted there. We also have posted two terminology documents that you see listed here. The first one I found particularly helpful in terms of terms. It explains simple things such as what's the difference between an electronic health record, an electronic medical record, and a patient's health record. Subtle differences in terminology as well as technical terms. So this was hopefully going to be, will be a helpful resource for folks. There's also two lists of points of contact people. The first one really is the results, I believe, of a survey that ASTHO did with CSTE on kind of the public health epi side of who's who in the states. And then the second listing is Medicaid, who in the Medicaid offices at the states are the contact people for meaningful use. So again, trying to get the word out as to who's who and who to contact, depending on where you sit in the state and what your questions are. We're also working on an introductory meaningful use slide set that can be used, it'll be public domain. Anybody can download it and adapt it for presentations to explain what meaningful use is in general terms, as well as some specifics for electronic lab reporting. The slide set also contains some critical, frequently asked questions from the effort that I mentioned earlier about FAQs, but it's not comprehensive. But it refers folks, it will refer folks to the public website where all of the facts are listed. And then the last product that I'm going to mention is something that we really deliberated on for several months, and that was whether we should develop a one-page flyer to explain what ELR is, why it's important to public health and to the nation, and why it's difficult and what it costs and what it requires to develop it. This is for the public. We finally decided that there was a need for it out there, that when you go to your politicians or to the public or to your constituents or to your health commissioner in a state or local health department, have to explain to them why you need $2 million to develop ELR, we thought it would be helpful to have a little one-page flyer, glossy, well-done flyer. And so that's been drafted and needs to be completed, and CSTE has agreed to publish that. Much of our work is complete, and we have a few ongoing activities. We need to complete the communications plan and the slides that I mentioned, and give the final vetting to the information sheet. So those will be completed, and then hopefully there'll be an end date for those. Some of the things that will be ongoing, of course, there will be questions. We need to have an ongoing mechanism, even after the work group finishes, for updating facts as they arise. And the communications plan for ELR and meaningful use will need to continue as well, and so we will be having those discussions. For those of you, I see some of our committee members in the audience, and I know that you're probably wondering, gee, I didn't know that we did all of that, because for the last 4 months we haven't had a call. And the reason we did that, Sanjeev and Jim and I and Shu have been kind of working behind the scenes, because we felt that rather than develop some of this material by committee, it was easier to get a straw man document ready for your review. So I want to thank all of the members. We had a number of meetings and calls with the members of this work group, and we're going to be reconvening you all shortly to go over some of the products that are in preparation that you haven't seen to finalize in the next month or two. So hopefully we will bring to conclusion our work. And again, I will end by saying I want to thank my co-chair, Jim, and Sanjeev and Shu. Laura Kahn was very instrumental along the way, especially early on, and our other committee members, but especially the CDC folks who have carried the brunt of the work and kept the momentum going. So my thanks to you all.
Thank you. And for those of you who happen to not know Perry from before, which I doubt is very many people, Perry was the former state epi of New York as well as the CSTE president for many years. So thank you so much, Perry. Our next work group to be speaking is the Resource and Capacity Work Group, and that was headed by Lori Smithy, who is with CSTE, and Dan Pollack, who is our CDC representative. Dan Pollack's day job is, since they all have day jobs, of course, is as branch chief of the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion. So please welcome Dan.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. For those of us who have been working in ELR and related activities for a good many years, I think we all recognize that it is indeed one of the successes of public health informatics for the last decade. And in many instances, it's been successful and grown on a shoestring. I look at JA back there, and I know in the state of Oregon, she is the chief cook, bottle washer, and everything in terms of state ELR, and has done such a magnificent job, not only in Oregon, but in spearheading national activities and in providing some intellectual and organizational leadership that's very crucial. And there are others of you in the audience, members of the work group likewise, who've taken on so much single-handedly or in small groups to move ELR forward, and we're all very grateful for that, because we're at a point now where we can talk about ELR and the way ahead, and we don't need to begin by demonstrating with studies that have been reported about the value of ELR and using ELR as an essential component of the public health surveillance armamentarium. But that said, we're also in an era where resources are incredibly constrained, where ELR programs and other core public health functions are deeply threatened, and that's just going to place an even higher premium on us making sure that we are focused on what we can do with what we've got, how to make the most of it, and frankly, to advocate for more. And a big part of what our work effort has been in the resource and capacity work group has been to develop a roadmap to ELR that we think will have value even in the context of a time where there may be retrenchment, rescission, and a reversal of fortune. Because going forward, it will be incumbent upon us to do what we can with what we've got and to work toward a better day when more will be available to capitalize on all that has been accomplished. So in short, let's not lose what we've done. Let's look at it realistically and do our utmost to march forward. And to that marching, we've hopefully added a roadmap to ELR that will help. And the roadmap is really a set of high-level project evaluation and planning resources that's relevant and intended to be relevant across state and local ELR efforts and across various stages of ELR project maturation. So we have attempted to develop a set of tools that we think have value regardless of what jurisdictional level you're working on and regardless of where you are in the life cycle of ELR. The components of the roadmap, as outlined on this slide, are process steps that need to be taken, roles that need to be filled, and resources needed to implement ELR or advance existing implementations. In addition to these components of the roadmap, we have a lessons learned summary about project planning, cost estimating, and timeline projections, and I'll go into that a little bit further later in the presentation. So our resource and capacity work group process checklist is outlined here. There are various process phases involved in ELR implementation, maintenance, and enhancement, beginning clearly with planning, continuing with engagement, also referred to as the onboarding of reporting labs, and then through a variety of additional process steps, culminating with process improvement and growth. So we developed this process checklist and other project planning resources using a method that involved our weekly work group meetings, a face-to-face meeting in Atlanta on May 23rd and 24th, and then interviews and follow-up interviews with participants from ELR activities in 8 states, one municipality, and one public health lab. So we've attempted to cull information and distill it from a relatively small sample, but we think one that does reflect some of the diversity of ELR experience. Each phase in this outline has associated functions. Each function is comprised of steps, and each step is detailed with a frequency, participants, a description, and the expected deliverables. So we have that in a document that, as with other task force resources, will be posted next month at a CSDE website. This slide lists the roles needed to implement, maintain, and enhance ELR. I want to emphasize that these are roles, they're not job titles, as some staff will work in multiple roles. We did a crosswalk of roles to skills and categorized the skills as primary and secondary. Then we asked state and local ELR representatives to describe their actual and ideal numbers of roles in their programs. And then Danny Martin, who along with Shu and John Abelera, did an absolutely incredible job supporting our work group activities. One of Danny's jobs was to compile estimates from the roles that were expressed in dollar amounts and number of hours. So we've got an hour and cost estimate associated with each of these roles and how they play out in ELR activities. And those cost estimates are summarized here, compiled into three phases: the startup, the engagement, and the onboarding, and the maintenance. These cost estimates clearly have to be caveated. I've mentioned already the small sample size of state, local, and public health lab inputs. Also, there are assumptions that were used to estimate these costs, and a number of factors account for a fairly wide range from the low and high at each phase, from startup through maintenance. Among these factors influencing cost are whether and how the NEDS-based system is used in a state, partnering with vendors, and the extent to which there may be some cost discounting, the size of a state in terms of its ELR reporting volume, the architectural model used in the state, do providers direct data through an HIE, health information exchange, does the state solution use an ASP, an application service provider model, or are ISPs leveraged as part of the overall solution? Finally, whether ELR was part of an integrated system or was a standalone. But with all the caveats, with all these variations, we think that there are several take-home messages, and Perry, they may figure into that publication intended for public use that that you described a moment ago. One of the take-home messages is that startup to maintenance does not involve a major drop-off in cost. And secondly, along the way, onboarding could actually involve an increase in costs as labs are brought on board. So it's very important for the public and policymakers to understand that this is not a one-shot deal. There are ongoing costs, and in fact, there can be increases in costs along the way. The products that we intend to be part of the product line that's going to be posted at the CST website are listed here. In terms of the lessons learned document, I should say, the lessons learned are relate to developing and maintaining the project plan, the need for cost estimation, strong communication, and the time and effort requirement for onboarding. The other work products that will be posted are the process checklist, the role description, and the resource estimate spreadsheet. Finally, and again to emphasize my personal thanks to Danny Martin, John Abelera, and Shu McGarvey. They have been lifesavers for Lori Smithy and myself as co-chairs. And then also the work group membership. I've had an opportunity to get to know some folks who I did not know before, some who I've known for many years. It's been a delight, and I've been very grateful for the opportunity to participate and contribute to this incredibly important project. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. We really have had great participation and patience from the work group members of this work group. Thank you so much to all of you who are out there who have participated in this effort. It's what it is at this point. It's a great starting point. We recognize that a formal study would probably be very beneficial in really drilling down to more specific costs. Our next work group is the LIS Vendor and Large Lab Work Group, and the CSTE chair for that was Tom Safranik of Nebraska. He's the state epi in Nebraska, and Dan Jernigan of CDC, who's sitting up front here, and we turn it over to you.
Thank you, Shu. I was one of that small number of people that was clapping this morning when Seth Foley asked who had started work on this stuff back in around 2000. I was with Bob and a small number of other people here at the meeting when we launched the whole NEDS project and have persisted to try and mature the whole system as it is expected to play out in its full force. The NEDS system, I think, was a fabulous project and a landmark in public health, and it continues to be an anchor and a benchmark and a workhorse for all state and local public health departments. And I think it really deserves a lot, the people who put that together deserve a lot of credit. Right from its inception, the NEDS project was contingent on two other dimensions. One was moving data in an automated electronic fashion into the system, and this is what we're talking about now, the automated electronic lab reporting. And the other dimension was moving the data out of the system upwards to the national level. And I would say probably if I were to give our NED systems a B plus or an A minus, I'd probably give our those other two dimensions a C plus or a B minus. And I'm thrilled to have gotten the attention of the CDC and the resources put together for these work groups to try and address that and elevate our grade. I was really interested in getting involved with the LIS vendors because, from my experience, this is where the real change can and should happen. And with the impetus of meaningful use, it was my perception that the vendors would be motivated, if not required, to actually develop the functionality that would allow their clients to move data from their lab systems to public health. And so I collaborated, and I thank Dan Jernigan, my partner. We had fabulous support, APHL, Jack Kruger, and Patina Zarconi, Monica Wang from CST. There were a variety of people, again, just like with all the other work groups, a fabulous support staff. It was a real team effort. Our interest was to connect with the LIS vendors, and I might say conceptually, I think all of us have to think about electronic lab reporting as three tiers. We have the large national laboratories, and really there are only four players of consequence there. That's LabCorp, Quest, Mayo Clinic, and ARUP. And then we have the LIS vendors, which more or less fall into two camps. There's five major LIS vendors, those being SunQuest, Cerner, McKesson, Meditech, and SoftSCC. And those five large vendors probably represent two-thirds to three-fourths of the LIS systems throughout the country. And then we have a second tier of LIS vendors. They're an important group, but in terms of volume, they're a second tier, I would say. And our interest is to see the extent to which the meaningful use requirement, along with pressure from the public health community, is incentivizing the LIS vendors to create the tools that allow their clients to effect automated electronic lab reporting, which is the selection in an automated way of those lab tests out of the universe of lab tests that need to be reported to public health to make sure those are properly coded, formatted, and securely messaged to public health in a standards compliant way. So that's really this slide, develop standards compliant and efficient approaches for the vendors to interface with public health, build on the work of the large national labs, LIS software solutions to include appropriate ELR standards in their products prior to certification. And how do I go to the next slide? Okay, good, sorry. Am I going backwards? The first thing we did is actually survey the vendors. There's about 37 vendors. We knew the four large national labs had already accomplished much of the work of automated ELR. LabCorp was the first one. Really, in about 2003, we started getting automated electronic lab reports from LabCorp. And I would say as you go down the list of the four large national labs, the extent to which a public health entity is not getting automated ELR from those entities is perhaps more a problem and a function of resources on the public health side than it is a capability issue on the part of the large national labs. I would say that LabCorp and Mayo Clinic do a splendid job. I'd give them an A, and they set a bar by which others could be measured. Quest comes in third. Because of their organizational setup, there's some heterogeneity in the Quest labs. ARUP does a great job on the non-microbiology, but they have not, in my opinion, invested as they should have in being able to report the microbiology results, things like culture results, stool culture, sputum cultures, et cetera, for things like salmonella or tuberculosis. Anyhow, we surveyed the commercial vendors who developed the software for the LIS systems. We're working on putting together a white paper for best practices for the LIS vendors and a white paper on what we can do to improve the efficiency and reduce the headache for the large national labs. When we surveyed the 37 vendors, 90% of them were aware of the CMS meaningful use requirement. So that was an important finding, that the word had actually gotten out and reached the LIS vendors. And I might say there's some controversy about that, because the meaningful use language talked about electronic health records, and there was for a while some confusion as to whether or not the LIS systems themselves were off the hook, and it was more a problem from an IT standpoint on electronic health records. And over time it became clear, number one, that many of the electronic health record systems out there are modular and rely on a proprietary standalone lab information system that has been integrated with an interface engine but has not been developed by the overarching electronic health record vendor. It became clear that we really needed to target anybody working on LIS software, whether they were a part of an electronic health record, such as, say, a McKesson, or whether they were a standalone LIS system that was integrated into an electronic health record along the lines of, say, a Sunquest. Having said that, 90% of them had gotten the message that there was a meaningful use requirement for electronic lab reporting. 93% either had or planned to develop software as part of their LIS products that will identify and message reportable labs to public health. 79% were aware of our implementation guide with the HL7251, and 84% had expressed an interest in participating in a workshop that included end-to-end testing of their ELR software. In a way, this was kind of good news, but you know, it was a web-based survey, and in a way, I guess I'm incredibly sensitive to, I don't know what I would call maybe something like vendor speak or exaggeration or whatever, where, you know, in a survey, it's I think there's a bias to, you know, report positive news and declare that your best intentions and your extraordinary capabilities. And I don't know that we've actually documented and followed through on that to see how many of these folks are actually walking the talk. And I think it's imperative for all of us in this room to assess and hold the LIS vendors accountable to see that they are conforming to what they had promised in this survey. Anyhow, we're working on a white paper to document the architectural options and best practices for reporting lab reports to public health. We're identifying several approaches that LIS vendors can take, providing pros and cons for different approaches and suggesting public health agencies receiving system outcomes. I would say my motivation, frankly, is that it looks very doable for a given laboratory with an LIS system to install ELR software that can do point-to-point reporting to public health. And I certainly am open and receptive and understanding of agencies, public health entities, that would prefer to have some of that work offloaded or consolidated. Depending on the size of the jurisdiction and the number of labs that are in that jurisdiction that are expected to report, in a state like ours, 1.8 million people, I feel like we as a public health agency are fully capable of serving as a hub and doing point-to-point reporting with all of the laboratories in our state. This is the workflow, and I guess many people in here are familiar with this, and this is really how the data flows. LIS collects the lab order, and they use local codes. They analyze the specimens and collect results. This is controversial where this box is here, this third box, because I don't know, and I could be mistaken, but I don't know of any lab in the country that's doing reporting to public health where they preemptively embed LOINC and SNOMED codes in a rigorous standardized fashion at the beginning of the process in their lab information system, and then filter for reportables identifying LOINC and SNOMED codes that are reportable to public health. And my experience is that labs will have the ability to filter and identify lab reports that are reportable to public health, but oftentimes they'll analyze and do that search and filtering based on their local codes, which works just fine. It may be, you know, in an overarching grand scheme of things, especially if you were building it from the ground up at the outset, one might have embedded and worked out this process from the get-go, but retrofitting electronic lab reporting into the existing business practices and models Pragmatically, I believe the labs have said we can accomplish what you want most efficiently by filtering on local codes, and then they apply LOINC and SNOMED codes afterwards as that data flows to public health. And those LOINC and SNOMED codes do fulfill useful purposes as they get to our NED systems. So they filter results and map to reporting vocabulary requirements. They generate an HL7 message. And this is one of the investments that Dan Pollack highlighted in terms of making sure that message is standards compliant and works with our NED systems. It's a major investment at the outset in developing an interface to make sure that all of the data elements are properly coded in HL7 message such that they populate the NED systems. So I think we've covered most of this. I would say we still have a lot of work to do in terms of validating that the LIS vendors are actually walking the talk. I can say from personal experience there are labs like SunQuest and Cerner, and I'm delighted actually to publicize these. And if we really want to have a big impact, there are 900 SunQuest labs in the country. They do a brilliant job of doing automated electronic lab reporting to public health using HL7 2.5.1. I know there are other labs that are still doing 2.3.1, and they haven't committed to do 2.5.1, but they do a very good job of doing 2.3.1 messaging. There are some labs, big labs, the McKessons and Meditechs, and I'm extremely interested in hearing from public health partners because I haven't been able to find out from the companies themselves as to whether or not their software has made it out into the field, whether it's been deployed, and whether there's an engagement going on between their client laboratories and public health in terms of accomplishing what meaningful use was expected to accomplish. We'll probably benefit from doing a follow-up survey to try and collect more information directly from the vendors. But I think it's going to be incredibly valuable to have our public health community say in our annual ELR survey that JA has helped author to document to what extent we have identified vendors who truly have developed software that can accomplish automated electronic lab reporting. Thank you very much.
And this work group also has done quite a bit of work with large labs. You just got a touch of that from Dr. Safranek, but if you have questions or would like to see more information on those, these slides will be available, and the publications, again, will be available on the CSTE website coming in September. So thank you so much. Last but not least is our legal considerations work group. See, he has many more slides. There you go. I do want to make one final note. Jack Kruger, thank you so much for all the work you've done. Jack is with APHL, and as with the Resource and Capacity Work Group, once again, we thank APHL for their help and their support with these work groups. So final work group, legal considerations. Our CDC co-chair is Fred Shaw, who is going to speak to us today. And our CSTE co-chair is David Blythe.
Thank you, Shu. I'm Frederick Shaw. I'm co-chair of the Legal Considerations Work Group, and my job today is to give you a very brief presentation on what we've done in our 24-member work group. Today I'll be talking about the results of a survey from that was conducted by CSTE, our partner in this work group, and also the results of some detailed interviews that we did with public health epidemiologists and public health legal counsel. I'm not going to be discussing the situation in any particular state, nor providing results for any particular state. Why? We've not finished this research, and because of some of the sensitivity of the information, we agreed with the state public health council not to identify any individual state's results until the final report has been reviewed. So, our charge, here you see it. First, to identify legal issues surrounding the implementation of ELR in the states. Some work on this had been done already by J.A. Magnuson's group, the National Electronic Laboratory Reporting Snapshot Survey, and this survey does ask a few limited questions on the legal situation with regard to ELR. Other than that, though, the work that this work group is doing is really the first time that someone's taken a detailed look at the legal considerations regarding ELR. A second charge was to research how states with illustrative or generalizable experiences have coped with legal issues. Law is very qualitative. Law is not quantitative, and there's no good way to assess laws quantitatively. To understand the law, you have to probe qualitatively and deeply into the workings of the law, and you have to talk to the people who are in charge of enforcing and drafting the law. A lot of lay people think that law is merely looking up the statute in the book and reading the black letter print that you see in the statute, but nothing could be further than the truth. Law is really just a prediction of what is going to happen to you if you don't follow a particular rule. That's what Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. said, the great jurist. So imagine that you're in a state and a public health attorney interprets her state's requirement on ELR to be merely voluntary. It's voluntary, and it's not mandatory. In that case, the black letter law written down in the statute book is not going to be very much interest to a large hospital or a large laboratory. They're really going to be more interested in what that public health law attorney thinks. So that's why it's crucial to talk to the people who are enforcing the laws, talk to the attorneys, the state officials, the private attorneys who are trying to enforce these laws and trying to follow them. And that's exactly what our work group did. We took a look at the black letter law in each state, the law that's printed in the statute books and the regulation books, which we also called up the state and talked to them in some detail for sometimes as much as a couple of hours, to asking them a lot of questions about how does that work, how does that relate to that, and so on. The third charge was based on the information we acquired, come up with some recommendations for tools that might be used to make it easier for other states. I'll skip this slide. So let me talk a little bit about the CST survey. As part of this work, CST launched a survey of all 50 states. They got responses from 49. 48 of the 49 responses were actually completed by the state epidemiologist. We had initially hoped that the responses would be made by the state legal counsel, but that turned out not to be practical. But about half of the state epidemiologists consulted their legal counsel before they filled out the survey. The results were used in part to determine what states would be good ones for subsequent interview in more detail. So here's some results. 27 of the 48 states said that the respondent said that they have laws interpreted by the respondent as regulating or governing ELR. This is a screening question. We asked this question as a screening question to allow us to go on to the next question. The second question we're going to talk about is 17 of the 49 states had laws interpreted by the respondent as requiring ELR. This is much different than the results obtained by the National Laboratory Reporting Survey, but the questions that were used in that survey were very different from the questions that we asked. That survey, for example, asked about used the word legislation. They inquired about the word legislation. Do you have legislation that does so and forth? We use the word law, but we defined law as either being a statute or a regulation. A legislation is a tricky word. A lot of people would view legislation only to mean a statute, or it could refer to a bill that's pending in the legislature. So the results of those two would be quite different. A third finding was that most states, 38 of 48, have not had to address any legal issues or controversies. No legal issues or controversies. This is somewhat surprising, really, but is it really? Keep in mind that public health statutes are very rarely litigated. Public health is not an area of a lot of litigation. In fact, those of us in the field sometimes feel there isn't enough litigation. If there were more litigation, we'd know more about the law because judges would have ruled on it. But what I think is more importantly, we learned that states have taken a lot of care to negotiate with the laboratories, to talk to the laboratories well ahead of any requirements, given them a lot of time, made some accommodations, and in cases where they adopted requirements, made them very, very reasonable so that the laboratories would have time to respond. And I think that's had a lot to do with the fact that there's been, in our, to our knowledge, not a single lawsuit nor a single regulatory appeal based on ELR. I could be wrong on that. If anybody in this room, I'm happy to be contradicted by that. And the fourth bullet here, only three of 49 states have laws that pose a barrier or obstacle to ELR implementation. Some more results. About a third of the respondents were of the opinion that additional laws would be desirable to better manage or address ELR-related legal concerns. These could be a variety of things, better statutes, and I'll talk about some of those in a minute. Just a small number of states anticipated that reporting laws would be needed to be modified in order for meaningful use. 60% of states had reporting laws that currently permit health information exchange, or at least don't prohibit it. We're continuing the analysis on this survey, and we'll have additional results in the fall. Let me wind up by talking about some of the in-depth interviews that we did. We interviewed a handful of states in great detail, as I mentioned. And these interviews were spearheaded by Molly Berkery, a newly minted attorney with an MPH from the University of Wisconsin, who worked full-time on this project during June and July and will be coming back in September to work on it further. Before we conducted the interviews, Molly did a detailed review of the black letter law, the law that's printed in the statute books and in the regulation books, to find out exactly how they read and how they looked. And we selected the states using a convenient sample. We knew that we used the results from the CSTE survey to select some states, but we also knew of certain states that were having issues with public health, with the adoption of ELR, possibly legal ones. We talked to people and they advised us on certain states that would be best to interview. What have we learned so far? What are the main findings? First, we learned that ELR law requirements are closely intertwined with state disease reporting statutes and regulations. It's hard to study ELR law without studying the reporting law as a more general matter. And so as we studied ELR law, we studied reporting law, and we found a lot about ELR law that we didn't know and a lot about general reporting law. One of our big findings was the huge variation in the way states handle ELR in their laws. This is not something that is really surprising, because if you study almost any area of public health law, you'll find huge variation. Immunization law, quarantine law. The states have huge variation in the way they handle things in their statutes and regulations. So this is not particularly surprising. Some states actually put a lot of ELR law and requirements into policy. It's not a statute passed by the legislature. It's not a regulation adopted by an executive agency. It's a policy that has quasi-legal status and is adopted by a state official, perhaps a state health commissioner. And those are of some extra interest for us, and I'll mention that in a minute. Is this variation a good thing or a bad thing? I'll leave that to you to decide. There was an IOM report on public health, a public health law that was published in July, and it really came out both ways. It's both a good thing and a bad thing, but that's for another conference. For me, the question is, do the laws work? And I think the general conclusion that we made is the ELR law in the states is working. And let me mention a couple of potential issues that we've identified that we're going to be spending some more time on. First is the hierarchical placement of ELR legal requirements in state law. The question here is, where's the best place to position a requirement? Do you want to put it in statute that has to be adopted by the legislature? Do you want to place it in a regulation that has to go through a rulemaking process? Or, in some cases, do you want to place it in policy, which has to go through neither one? Each one has its risks and its benefits. For example, placing something in a statute means it'll be very difficult to change, because in order to change it, you're going to have to go to the legislature. But that can be a risk, but it can also be a benefit. In some situations, you don't want the legislature to open up your statute. In other situations, you might want them to. if you want to place it in regulation where it's fairly easy to change. In most states, a regulation can be changed by simple rulemaking procedure. But in some states, it's extremely difficult to do that. In Florida, for example, we heard that even to get an emergency regulation adopted can take several months. So that might be an argument for placing something in policy if you're able to do it. In Florida, they're not. Second is the level of specificity. Where do you wish to place specification about, say, for example, your messaging standards, your HL7 version? If you place them in statute, you'll have to ask the legislature to change that when you want to change versions. You wouldn't want to do that. If you place them in administrative rule, it could be quick and easy to do that. If you place them in policy, they might not have the force of law that you really want them to have. They could be challengeable in certain situations. So there's a lot of thinking that has to go into that. Finally, let me just mention the use of policy, something that I just talked about. This means placing a requirement or a legal mandate in a level of law that is below statute, below regulation, is merely a discretion of an official. Quite a few states do that for reporting laws and for aspects of ELR. In most cases, there haven't been any litigation that we know of. There hasn't been any problem where these have been found to lack the force of law. But in theory, in some cases, they might. Why? Because each state in the nation has something called an Administrative Procedures Act. The Administrative Procedures Act of a state, and all 50 states have them, specifies how state agencies can act to make people do things and adopt rules, take actions, and so on. We're concerned that sometimes when a mandate is placed merely in policy and at the discretion of the official, say the Commissioner of Health, it might be a problem with the state's Administrative Procedures Act. And it could be challengeable on that basis. It hasn't been challenged so far, and we don't know of any instances where it would be, but it certainly is a question that we would like to delve further into. It's a very interesting question for lawyers to think about. Does it have any practical application for the states? We don't know. It depends on what kind of delegation was made from the legislature, what kind of regulation was passed by the administrative agency, and the judgment, like I said at the beginning, the judgment of the Public Health Council, which is all important. Thank you.
I think you saw me grabbing the two-minute notice. Here's the Legal Considerations Work Group. As Fred said, there were quite a few participants across the jurisdictions and quite a bit of work that is still being done to be completed in the early January to March timeframe. We'd like to thank all of the work groups for the work that they've done. And all of you who have been helping as well for your input. We'd like to leave some time for questions. I'm going to skip these transitional meeting slides. I do want to point out there are quite a number of ELR sessions. There are so many they wouldn't fit on one slide, so here's the second slide. There's a number on RCMT. There's ones on the reportable condition knowledge base. And other knowledge-based work that has been going on, some on FLIP, ELR process steps. JA is giving a presentation on Tuesday. So please, you'll see all of these in your agenda. We do want to leave some time for questions. There's a resource slide. The Meaningful Use website at CDC provides you links to the ELR task force. There is an ELR task force website as well through CSDE. Through CDC, and there will be soon through CSTE. So that being said, we would like to take questions now.
Or comments.
Or comments. Yes. Yes. Can you stand up, please? And is there a... Hang on 1 second, we'll bring you a mic.
Is that going to flip a switch or something? I don't know.
And Fred, I think this is for you. So there's a mic here, and there's one here.
I don't know if we got to flip the switch or
In states that have legislative mandates to, and specifically and diversion, did you come across any examples of like non-compliant labs with those states, and any strategies to work with labs to comply with the legislation?
That for me.
That's for you.
We didn't ask that, or I should say CST did not ask that as part of the survey, so we don't have any systematic way of knowing that. But in the states that we've interviewed so far, that enforcement has really not been an issue. Enforcement for ELR violation, ELR law violations, vary tremendously from state to state and may default to, you know, failure to report disease, which we all know is not an enforcement mechanism that the states use almost ever. So we didn't spend a lot of time looking at that. From the states we've talked to so far, persuasion and collegiality seems to be the approach that's working.
Next question or comment?
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So, now that those of you who have not been part of this process have heard about it, are there areas that jump out at you and say, oh, I wish they had taken that one on or taken that one on differently? Or is it all making sense and we're well on our way to wrapping it up in a coherent product?
So what's missing?
So silence will indicate you're all happy with it.
Yes. So the question was, are there any plans across states to standardize the legal aspects of this? It's a good question.
The simple answer to that is no, probably not. When the work group first started, there was some consideration given to possibly creating a model law. But model laws are fraught with difficulty and are very, very difficult to create. The recent menu for tuberculosis that you may have seen created by CDC was over 2,000 person hours of work. So at this point, we don't have any plan to do that. I think by the mere publication or promulgation of our results will help some states to see how they could maybe have done better or how they would like to change their procedures in the future. For example, when Connecticut rewrote their statute, the statute was actually drafted by the state epidemiologist, and he consulted very heavily with another state in drafting that. So cross knowledge and cross communication between the states is probably preferable to a model law.
Yes.
I just have some comments based on what the doctor for Franek was saying earlier. From Louisiana. In Louisiana, we've had success kind of targeting LIS vendors as well as health systems that are going to use a certain type of vendor. And I think you kind of asked about our success rate with those, who we've had success with. And we've done pretty well with Cerner directly. And under health systems, we've had success with Quest being, not, excuse me, not Quest, I'm not trying to say, Meditech and Sunquest.
Fascinating. Yep.
But just, I did want to say something. You said the five major labs and them all using electronic lab reporting, that if they're not doing it, then it must be something on the public health end.
Mm.
I would have to differ on one of those labs in particular.
Mm. There are issues with some of the major labs, but I would say that they've demonstrated the ability to do it, and they did so a long time ago, LabCorp and Mayo Clinic, and maybe we need to extend an olive branch to, you know, Quest or ARUP and, you know, consult. I think there's some work to be done there. Yeah.
As,
Thank you. Good comment and question. Others? Yes. Brian, yes.
Use that mic.
Hang on, the mic is coming. Since we have a virtual conference, we found that we want to capture questions, and that gets missed without the mic.
So I think this question is for Perry, but one of the things I think will be very powerful and useful for states is that the terminology and acronym location that you're talking about publishing. But one of the challenges with a document like that is that it's going to become out of date within weeks as new terms are thrown out by the ONC. In fact, they've kind of in the last 3 months, they've changed the description of some of the terms they use for health information exchanges. What's the commitment or what will be the process for maintaining that work group product?
You're raising a major issue, I think, for a lot of aspects of informatics and public health and throughout everything you've heard today for ELR. And the work groups and the task force are probably not going to continue forever. It's a huge commitment in terms of what we've CSTE, APHL, and CDC has done. So this is a major question that we're going to be taking up with the steering committee next month, is what still needs to be done. There's some unfinished work, but I think the bigger, more difficult question is one you're asking, and I don't have all the answers because it takes resources. Everything that just our work group did is, in fact, some of it that we've already done is out of date now. And how do you maintain that is a major question. So we understand, I think we all understand the issue you're raising and in the ongoing need. And it's, as I say, on the agenda for the discussion at our meeting in September.
It is noon, and I know everyone is ready for lunch most probably, but if you have other questions, please feel free to come forward, and thank you so much for attending this session today.